Because turnout is very important. We know that when there's a high turnout, there's a big possibility of us winning the state. And so we are making sure that we're mobilizing. We have thousands of volunteers across the state. We also have thousands of volunteers across the country who are calling into different states that are key for us. And that has definitely been, you know, what has pushed Bernie Sanders forward until June. And, you know, we're not gonna stop. It doesn't matter what pundits, it doesn't matter what, the establishment tells us, we're gonna continue until
What do
we
you
win.
Say when people say, well, he won in white states, like, for example, they say Washington State?
Right. Well, look, in Washington, we went into Yakima. He's one of the about 45% to 50% of the community there is Latino. Very diverse county. Bernie had a rally there. We had 7,000 people turn out. We ended up winning the county by 75% or 76%. It was amazing turnout. It was also great support that we had. And it's a very diverse community. And so it's, you know, it's unfortunate that there is this narrative now out there. You know, first Alaska was a most diverse state. Now it's not the most diverse state. The reality is that Latinos,
we have to leave it there.
Of course.
I want to thank you for being with us, Erica Andiola. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
What happens when Oz and Wonderland collide in a twisted brain of a mad composer? A freaking musical, of course. KBOO is proud to present Nick T. Devlin's new musical, Alice Trippin' Sixes. It's a strange and unusual music odyssey. Flying monkeys, scarecrows, jokers, and even midday tokers. Oh, this ain't your normal musical, man. It's a far-out psychedelic trip into the mind of the mad. This is going to be one wild and crazy musical event. Alice Trippin' Sixes, Thursday, March 31st at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
On Progressive Spirits, I welcome back Bart Ehrman to talk about his new book, Jesus Before the Gospels, how the earliest Christians remembered, changed, and invented their stories of the Savior.
They remember Jesus as the one who wants people to be successful and rich. And you have other people who are saying that Jesus was a complete anti-materialist. Those kinds of different memories go all the way back in early Christianity.
Weekly podcasts on KBOO.fm/Progressive Spirit.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting Widespread Panic's only Northwest shows July 2nd and 3rd. Tickets for Widespread Panic's summer concerts on sale Friday at bendconcerts.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new research shows all wines grown in Napa Valley are contaminated with the active ingredient in Roundup pesticide.
Got five-year-olds? It's time to register them for kindergarten.
And today is Minoru Yosui Day. Join us in honoring one of Oregon's greatest attorneys who changed the course of history in our state.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 28th, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. A lockdown of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. was lifted this afternoon after reports of shots fired at the U.S. Capitol closed the multi-building complex just before 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Press reports do not say what happened to the shooter, other than the fact that he is, quote, still in surgery. An alert email to Capitol Hill staffers after 3:30 p.m. informed them the House, Senate, and Library of Congress buildings had been returned to normal operation. Unconfirmed reports said the shooter was Larry Dawson of Antioch, Tennessee, who was arrested at the Capitol last year after shouting, quote, "I am a prophet of God," from the witness's balcony at the U.S. House of Representatives.
Washington's new background check law has blocked 50 gun purchases by felons during its first 14 months in effect. The FBI reports that its criminal background check database showed nearly 4,000 felons were caught trying to buy a firearm in Washington state last year after the implementation of the state's gun law, including the 50 private sales that are now regulated because of Initiative 594. The law passed in November 2014 and established universal background checks for all gun sales, including those between private citizens. In Washington state, guns sold by licensed firearms dealers already required background checks.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has declined to choose a new police superintendent from the list of finalists offered by the police board, formed to select candidates, and instead appointed his own nominee. Emanuel chose from within house by naming Eddie Johnson, a near three decades long veteran of the Chicago Police Department who's been acting as the chief of patrol since the recent ousting of Gary McCarthy. The mayor sought McCarthy's resignation weeks after the video of Laquan McDonald's death in a confrontation with police was made public late last year. More than 20 officers with the CPD have been disciplined for improper use of audio and video equipment since questions arose about the blocks of missing sound from the McDonald video footage. After the department announced more strict guidelines regarding the use of AV equipment, it was discovered that 80% of dash cams had no functioning audio, according to a department spokesman. Video of McDonald's death came on top of a scandal comparing the Chicago Police's Homan Square facility to a black ops torture chamber reminiscent of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. In December, Emanuel invited the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate the city's police department, and according to reports late last week, the case has already cost $750,000 in legal fees. Civil suits brought by people who claim they were wrongfully arrested and illegally detained at the Homan Square facility are ongoing as well.
The Lane County Sheriff's Office is back to full staffing for the first time in almost 2 years. The department reports that retirements thinned its ranks so they couldn't hire and train enough officers to patrol the streets around the clock until now. The Associated Press reports that Corvallis Sheriff's patrols were cut back to 20 hours a day in 2010 and 16 hours a day in 2012.
Mark your calendars for the Corvallis Police Department Cops and Robbers class. The 10-week class is designed to give citizens a look inside the department so they can learn more about who runs it and how. Department officials say they welcome people who hold opinions critical of Corvallis Police. Applicants for the class must pass a background check and have had their 16th birthday by April 6th of this year. Those under 18 must be accompanied in class by a parent or guardian. The department is accepting applications through the end of March. Get the application at Corvallis, Oregon, all one word, .gov/police, and follow the links to crime prevention and look for cops and robbers. If you have questions, email copsandrobbers@corvallisoregon.gov.
A new study has found that the vast majority of California wines, even those grown with organic grapes, contain glyphosates. The active ingredient found in Roundup and 700 other glyphosate-based herbicides. The test found that every single wine sample taken in Sonoma, Mendocino, and Napa County contained glyphosates. The test found that even wines produced with organic grapes still contain the glyphosate herbicide, but at levels 25 times less than wines made conventionally with conventionally grown grapes. The World Health Organization has deemed glyphosates to be a probable carcinogen, and that even a minuscule amount of glyphosates can stimulate the growth of breast cancer cells. The three counties in the heart of California's wine country have an almost 2% higher rate of breast cancer than the rest of the country. The use of herbicides containing glyphosate are currently allowed on more than 160 different food and feed crops by the EPA. A California Department of Pesticide registry showed that more than 57,000 pounds of Roundup was used in Napa County alone each year over the last several years. Once applied, glyphosate can remain viable for up to 20 years.
The newest high school in the Beaverton School District, South Cooper Mountain, is currently under construction with plans to open next year. The development plans called for keeping the giant walnut tree at the edge of the site on the corner of Southwest 175th Avenue and Shoals Ferry Road. But as of the past week, the tree's no longer there. According to Beaverton Washington School District spokesperson Maureen Wheeler, the tree was cut down due to the need to slope the corner of the site and build a retaining wall. Wheeler said that arborists from both the school district and the city of Beaverton examined the walnut tree and determined it would not be able to live through the planned construction, so the tree was removed. The question remains, why didn't the arborists examine the tree and confer with planners last summer before the district committed to keeping it? We followed up with Maureen Wheeler, and we'll have that audio for you on tomorrow's 5 p.m. news.
On Friday, a federal court found an Oregon law protecting salmon streams from gold mining operations to be legal. The law, passed during the 2013 state legislative session, went into effect this year and limits suction dredging and other motorized mining operations in Oregon's prime trout and salmon streams. After the law was passed, gold mining operators unsuccessfully sued the state of Oregon in federal court in an attempt to have the law overturned. The law, Senate Bill 838, allows the state of Oregon to regulate land usage on both state and federal lands in order to protect water quality and wildlife habitat. Suction dredging and other motorized mining operations in streams has been found to release large plumes of mercury into the streams, leading to high toxicity levels in fish. The mining operations also destroy water clarity, leading to protests from other river and stream users such as rafters and anglers. The law expires in 2022, but environmental groups are lobbying the Oregon legislature to make the law permanent.
Oregon Housing and Community Services announced today they're giving $9.35 million to a fund administered by nonprofit groups helping individuals save money for important goals such as home buying, paying for college, or starting a small business. The network of participating nonprofit organizations is called the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative. Officials say almost 5,000 people participated in the program last year, 43% saved for an education, 29% saved for a new home, and 20% saved to open a small business. Organizers say the remaining 8% are saving to restore a home to a livable condition or purchase equipment to support employment. In 2016, the Oregon IDA initiative includes additional savings categories because the 2015 Oregon legislature approved an expansion of the reasons for which people can save. These awards will give people access to saving for retirement, paying down educational or medical debt, and more. People interested in learning how they can save for an individual development account should visit Oregon IDA Initiative, and that's all one word, OregonIDAInitiative.org/apply. It's the time of year when families of young kids start thinking about kindergarten. Local educators want to persuade families to register for school by June. Here to speak with us about kindergarten signups is Brooke Chilton Timmons, the Multnomah County Schools Uniting Neighborhoods Early Learning Director. Brooke, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brooke, first of all, for people who don't know, what is Schools Uniting Neighborhoods, or SUN?
Sure. SUN is a unique partnership between Multnomah County, the City of Portland, school districts, and nonprofits with two primary goals: that we want to increase the academic success for all students, and we also want to reduce poverty in our community. Probably the most visible part of SUN are the 85 different SUN community schools that are in all six of the primary school districts in Multnomah County.
And what if I have a five-year-old? What do I need to do?
We're asking folks to please register for kindergarten if your child will be five by September 1st. This is the time right now, if you haven't already, to please go to your local school and to register. And if you don't know what your local school is or your local school district, you can call 211 or text 211, and they're able to help you determine where is your school and the school district that can give you the right information.
Brooke, we've seen the term community school strategy. What is a community school strategy?
Sure. So a community school is an opportunity for, so we have nonprofit partners who are in local public schools, and community schools are hubs of activity where families can go and access services. That might be an after-school program, a before-school program. It might be a food pantry, but it's a way to change how schools operate and for services to be located where families already go. So they're able to get additional support that they might need for their students to be successful and for their family to be successful.
That sounds like SUN's second mission there of combating poverty in terms of providing food and after-school resources for kids?
Definitely. And we also know that the summer programs that we provide, both for kids that are in elementary, middle, and high school, as well as for kids who are entering kindergarten, are a key piece to provide to prevent summer learning loss that we know a lot of children who don't have access to summer camp or other opportunities during that break from school. This is a chance for them to access some great services and prevent that summer learning loss that we see.
And what if your kid's kindergarten teacher wants to do a home visit? What does that involve?
Sure. So we had 19 schools who this summer and fall participated in a program called Parent Teacher Home Visit Project, and they received training about visiting families, and it was a scheduled visit, and they would go into a family's home and talk about what are the hopes and dreams that a parent has for their child, and how can I as a teacher help you achieve those hopes and dreams that you have. So it's just a chance for parents and teachers to get to know each other in a different way. And I think it's a really exciting way for authentic relationships to be built between teachers and parents.
What are the parents usually trying to accomplish with those home visits? That's new to me. I mean, that seems like a fantastic program.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting work. I mean, I think for parents, they want to get to know, who's this person that's going to be taking care of my child? Who, you know, they have, there's a lot of trust that involves sending your child off to school. And so I think for them, it's really understanding more about who this teacher is and how they can work together.
And who makes house calls anymore? That's surprising.
And do you offer the early kindergarten transition? I mean, what is it and why is that important?
So that's another way that we are trying to support families as they enter into kindergarten. So at 42 different schools this summer, there will be a 2 to 3 week free summer program for entering kindergartners and their families. It's a chance for the children to practice kindergarten because many of them haven't had any preschool experience before. And it's a chance for parents to learn about, what is kindergarten like now? It's changed a lot from when they were in kindergarten. There aren't naps anymore in kindergarten. They're doing math, or kids are learning how to read. And so it's important that parents understand what's happening during the school day. And it's also a chance for them to get to know the school staff and to get to know each other. It's really nice to have a mom down the street you can call if you're sick and you can't take your kid to school. So building those relationships with the school, as well as your neighbors and other parents at the building.
So kids who start kindergarten and they don't have preschool experience, I would assume they're at a disadvantage, and this is a way of overcoming that? Or
it can be challenging for kids who've never had any formalized school experience, and so this is one way for them to practice school before they get there, to practice routines and to raise their hands, to learn where the bathroom is. I mean, all of those important things that can be stressful when you're five and entering this big building with lots of other kids.
What are some of the other challenges of kindergarten for parents? You mentioned some of the challenges for kids.
Yeah.
You know, they're in this strange environment and they have to find their way around. Mm-hmm. What about parents?
I think for the entire family, it's a huge transition. A lot of parents find that preschool environment, if they are able to access preschool for their children, to be really supportive and open. And sometimes schools can be a little bit harder for parents to engage with. And so it's learning an entirely new system. I think the other important thing that can be challenging is just stressing the importance of consistent kindergarten attendance. I think that many families don't realize how important it is for kids to go to kindergarten every day that they're well. Research shows that students who don't attend kindergarten consistently fall behind their peers, and those differences, those academic differences, can stay with them until fifth grade. So it really is important that when kids get behind by a few days, it catches up with them, and it's hard, it's stressful for the child, and it's hard for them to catch up. So that consistent kindergarten attendance is key.
Oh, I just want to follow up on that. What are some of the reasons a child would not attend kindergarten on a consistent basis?
I think that that's a challenging, complex question. I mean, I think poverty is a huge reason that families who are undergoing a lot of stress, who are struggling to feed their families, that getting to school might not be the first thing that they need to think about. I think there are a lot of other barriers, whether those be transportation, your car breaks down, and it's really difficult to get to school that day. And I think for older students, they may need to care for younger siblings at times. So there's lots of different reasons, but I think that families are doing their best, and that's part of why we want to share this message that attendance is really key for their students' well-being.
And for families that don't manage to get their kids signed up by June, what do they need to do? What happens then?
Well, I think for families who don't have a chance to sign up before June, they may not be able to access some of those services. So like the early kindergarten transition program, they wouldn't know about those programs happening. So by registering, they will get the information they need. A lot of schools are also offering times for parents and their kids to come to the playground and to meet each other and to start building those important relationships or having connect to kindergarten events. So it's a really important thing so that if you are registered, you'll get that information from the school building about the opportunities that are available to you, as well as things like summer lunch programs. Many of the schools that we work with are providing lunches throughout the summer. And so it's another resource that families can access if they're already connected and they're getting that information from schools.
So a child who's starting kindergarten, say in the fall, can go and get lunches throughout the summer. And that's in addition to getting the food, of course, it would be one way of orienting the child to this new environment.
Definitely. And those meals are open to any child under 18, but it's just a matter of do families know about it? And so it's one more chance. I also think it just makes the transition smoother and more calm. Again, I mean, change is difficult for all of us. And so it's really important that we provide as many supports as we can to make that change for the entire family easier.
Okay, Brooke, we're signing up by June.
Great.
So what do we need to do and where do we go?
So the first stop would be your neighborhood school, unless you are not sure where that is. So if you have questions about where your school is or even which school district you may be in, please call 211 and find out so that you can go to the right place and get the information that you need.
Brooke, how long has this program been around? It seems incredible in terms of the services. I mean, you read all the time now about services getting cut back. And this is something that I didn't have as a kid. And my parents obviously didn't have it. And I don't think my kids had it either. So it seems a great advantage for kids entering kindergarten these days. So I guess my question is when did it start and what were the reasons for it?
So there's multiple things. I mean, I think the early kindergarten transition program, that started in 2010 with Portland Public Schools, had two schools that they were offering this program in, and other districts started to hear about it and get super excited because it is exciting work and an opportunity for them to connect with families earlier. And so we're now in, we're slowly growing. And like I said, that we're in 42 different schools this summer because school districts and parents, and teachers have really seen the benefit for the program.
Well, Brooke, thanks very much for coming into KBOO and teaching us all about that program. It is amazing
what
you guys
offer.
So that was Brooke Chilton-Timmons. She's the Early Learning Coordinator for the Sun Service System and Community Schools. Learn more about signing up for school at multco.multco.us/sun/register. And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Bernie Sanders had a huge weekend, crushing Hillary Clinton in three states with more than 70% of the Democratic vote in Washington State, Alaska, and Hawaii. Clinton still holds a large lead in delegates and endorsements from labor unions and elected officials. In Madison, Wisconsin, Senator Sanders brought a strong pro-union message to thousands of fervent supporters.
100-plus years ago, when workers in this country were being ruthlessly exploited, being overworked, being underpaid, they stood up and said, "We are not animals, we are human beings. We are going to form trade unions." And we owe our brothers and sisters in the trade union movement, we owe them a whole lot for helping to create a 40-hour work week and helping to create the middle class of this country. And let me tell Governor Walker, he may have won a short-lived victory here against the unions, but that short-term victory will not stand in the long run. We are going to rebuild the trade union movement.
Labor for Bernie activists in Wisconsin are pushing hard for a Bernie Sanders win in the April 5th presidential primary here. Former Wisconsin AFL-CIO President David Newby.
We really need a clear clear-cut progressive victory here in Wisconsin, a victory that's going to make a real difference in this state, both here in Wisconsin and all across the country. And it's for that reason, I think, that union members, in my experience, have really been breaking decisively for Bernie. And Wisconsin can really be the turning point in this campaign.
Former Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says the Sanders campaign can still win if his supporters keep up the organizing for his political revolution.
What I say to people is every vote and every delegate is going to matter in building this movement, as well as in winning that Wisconsin primary in just less than 2 weeks. We're building a permanent organization. It's not going to disappear.
Labor for Bernie activists are inspired that despite Sanders' uphill battle for the Democratic nomination, a victory and a political revolution are both possible if the grassroots insurgency continues to work hard.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
California Governor Jerry Brown has reached an agreement with the state legislature and public unions to increase the state's minimum wage up to $15 an hour over the next several years. Currently, the minimum wage in California is $10 per hour. The proposed bill would increase the wage by 50 cents on January 1st of 2017, up to $10.50 per hour, followed by another 50-cent increase in 2018. Starting in 2019, the minimum wage would increase by $1 per hour until reaching $15 per hour in the year 2021. The governor negotiated the wage increase in order to halt a proposed ballot measure that would have increased the minimum wage at an even faster rate than the newly proposed law. The bill still needs to move through the California legislature before becoming law, but with the public unions, the governor, and the majority of state legislatures behind the increase, expect it to be approved.
Blocked from ending federal funding for Planned Parenthood by President Barack Obama's veto, Republicans are achieving their goals state by state instead. The Associated Press reported today that more than a dozen states have sought to stop or cut public funding for Planned Parenthood over the past year. That includes Florida, where Governor Rick Scott signed a bill Friday banning state funding for the organization's services. The conservative campaigns against funding for women's health have prompted Planned Parenthood to drop contraceptive services, health screenings, and other programs serving thousands of low-income women. Many of the measures kicked off after conservative activists falsely reported that Planned Parenthood sold fetal tissue to researchers for a profit in violation of federal law. Two activists were charged in January for tampering with government records in the false reporting case. One was indicted on a misdemeanor count related to attempting to purchase human organs. The grand jury found Planned Parenthood innocent of the accusations.
A new North Carolina law preventing local government from creating anti-discrimination rules and requiring transgender students to use bathrooms assigned to their biological sex is the target of a lawsuit filed today. Two transgender people and a lesbian law school professor file suit to block the new laws with help from several civil liberties groups. The new gender rules were passed last week by the legislature and signed into law by Republican Governor Pat McCrory. The issue started when Republican lawmakers decided to overturn an impending Charlotte ordinance allowing transgender people to use the bathroom aligned with their gender identity. But the new law also prevents all cities and counties from extending protections covering sexual orientation and gender identity at restaurants, hotels, and stores. The American Civil Liberties Union, Lambda Legal, and Equality North Carolina scheduled a Monday news conference in Raleigh to discuss lawsuit deals.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio and Prison Pipeline at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is 64 degrees and sunny. Today in history, in 1979, the nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania barely avoided a full-on meltdown in the worst nuclear accident so far on U.S. soil. 2 days later, it was discovered that radiation had in fact leaked, prompting more than 100,000 people to flee surrounding towns. The quote of the day is from author H.G. Wells. He said, "Every time I see an adult on a bicycle, I no longer despair for the future of the human race."
It's 5:29. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Why should you and I have to keep paying Mitch McConnell's salary? He's the Senate Majority Leader, but he doesn't lead. And he really doesn't do much of anything, refusing to pick up the legislative tools he's been given and go to work on the many things that we the people need Congress to do. Imagine if you tried drawing your paycheck after ignoring your workload. McConnell says no to every task at hand. Repair and replace the water pipes that leach lead and are poisoning families all across America? No, he yawns. Raise the minimum wage to help bridge the dangerous wealth gap separating the super rich from the rest of us? Don't bother me with such stuff, Mitch snaps. Shut off that gusher of corrupt corporate money pouring into our elections and drowning the people's democratic rights? Not my problem, shrugs the lumpish ne'er-do-well. And now, a straightforward constitutional duty has been handed to McConnell. Gear up the Senate's advising consent mechanism to approve or reject President Obama's nominee to replace the deceased Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. "Manana," muttered the somnolent senator, though he really means next year, long after Obama is gone. We're paying this guy a salary of $174,000 a year, plus another $19,000 to serve as majority leader. It's insulting to taxpayers that he won't even go through the motions of doing his job. Of course, saying no to all the chores he ought to be doing for the people is exactly what the corporate sponsors of his Republican Party expect from him. They want an inert and unresponsive government, a poverty wage economy, a plutocratic election system, and a court of their own choosing. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, do nothing Mitch McConnell is their boy. But at least, shouldn't the corporations that he serves have to pay his salary rather than sticking us with the cost?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Colombian General Henry Torres has been arrested for killing civilians in combat 10 years after the crimes were committed. Torres reportedly turned himself in on Monday as soon as the arrest order was issued. He becomes the highest-ranking officer ever to be charged with such a crime in Colombia, but more might soon follow. Officials also say they'll try to take into custody retired General Mario Montoya, a close ally of former President Alvaro Uribe. Investigators say security forces killed thousands of civilians to inflate body counts on which bonuses and vacations were based. Torres' arrest comes as a leading human rights group warned that a deal between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia to end the country's decades-long conflict would allow top officers to escape jail time or avoid prosecution altogether. Under the proposed terms of a peace agreement accord already agreed to by both sides, rebels and state agents who confess their crimes will be spared jail time. Instead, they'll be sentenced to a maximum 8 years of labor on projects to rebuild communities torn apart by the conflict.
It's been a decade since Western powers placed economic sanctions on the Gaza Strip after Hamas won Palestinian parliamentary elections. Shortly after Hamas took power in March of 2006, the U.S., EU, and Canada cut aid to the Palestinian Authority, causing a deep factional rift between Palestinian parties Hamas and Fatah. Israel followed suit in 2007 with a total blockade of the territory. The isolation has infused every aspect of life in the Gaza Strip, including its music scene. But a new band has started performing across the region, aiming to keep traditional Palestinian music alive. FSRN's Rami Almegari reports from Gaza.
Inside Gaza City's landmark Al-Mishal Theater, 24-year-old Rowan Okasha rehearses a traditional rural Palestinian love song titled I Wish You Were My Soulmate. The folk song is one of many the band called Dawaween has updated with modern elements since it began performing about 4 months ago. Okasha says she has been singing since she was 3, but never in public until her performances with Dawaween, preserving Palestinian musical traditions, runs in her family. Her father is a famous Gaza musician, and 2 of her brothers are well-known local singers.
Palestine can be happy, and Palestine's cultural heritage is filled with joy that could be shared with the outside world.
Tenny musicians and 2 other singers, both male, make up the 13-member band, including 23-year-old Abdurrauf Albelbaisi.
As local musicians, we often hold wedding parties as part of our culture, but these parties don't necessarily involve the traditional Palestinian songs that we perform.
The experienced lute player and singer explains why it's important to him to keep these traditional songs alive.
I am a Palestinian who's been raised in a folk culture context that includes, for example, eating a traditional fire stove bread. I'm drawn to these traditional Palestinian songs that refer to our cultural items.
The band's Egyptian-Palestinian manager Adel Abdurrahman says Dawaween is a volunteer effort and receives limited financial support from an Egyptian cultural association. They have had sponsorship offers but turned them down in order to remain independent of any politically affiliated groups.
We have received offers of huge financial support by various partisan groups. We have rejected them all, even though we're broke.
Years of border blockades and heavy restrictions on travel and trade to and from Gaza have affected nearly every aspect of life here, and that includes even simple cultural activities taken for granted in other parts of the world. The thirst for live music was evident at the band's most recent concert. Gaza City resident Majdi Abu Amir attended the performance along with 2 of his friends.
This music projects a real message from Gaza that Gaza is not only a place of bombing and destruction. We, the people of Gaza, are as normal as many others in the world. We listen to music, we love, and we watch movies.
Live music performances like Dawaween's concert are rare occurrences in the Gaza Strip ever since the 2007 start of the Israeli blockade of the coastal territory. 3 major Israeli military offensives targeting Gaza since then have only increased the hardships that are now part of everyday life here. For theater director Jamal Abul Komsan, keeping Palestinian music and culture alive is vital for the nearly 2 million people here who are largely isolated from the rest of the world.
Music in itself is considered a different form of resistance. I think the music helps people be more patient and tolerant towards life, and it enables them to enjoy some time out.
Dawaween is set to hold a concert once a month and looks forward to expanding its activity far and wide in the coastal territory. Tours overseas, however, seem unlikely given the travel restrictions that come with being a resident of the Gaza Strip. For Rafa Saran, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
The damage done to the ancient city of Palmyra in Syria is now coming to light since Syrian army troops drove out ISIS fighters who bombed historic holdings there. The militant group had been in firm control of the town, which is locally known as Tadmur, since May of last year. ISIS troops reportedly destroyed ancient ruins and executed scholars, much as they did after the takeover of Mosul and Nineveh province in Iraq a year earlier. Palmyra was the center of the short-lived Palmyrene Empire in the 3rd century AD, a Roman splinter state under Empress Zenobia, whose story carries deep meaning for Syrian nationalists. The Syrian army's retaking of Palmyra follows its capture of the highest points overlooking the town last week. The army has been backed up in their efforts by Russian bombers, which have flown more than 20 missions daily against Islamic State positions in the town in the past few weeks.
As Syrian troops continued to gain ground against the Daesh terrorist group, also known as ISIS, the group has increasingly struck beyond the borders of Syria and Iraq. On Easter Sunday, suicide bombers struck a park in Pakistan, killing 70 people, including 29 children. This follows the attacks last week on Brussels that left more than 35 dead and 300 injured. In Syria, government troops have retaken the ancient city of Palmyra from Daesh, who had held the town since May of last year. Reports are emerging that many ancient temples were destroyed by the Daesh terrorist group, who call the temples blasphemous. Meanwhile, reports have emerged that the King of Jordan, during a meeting in January with U.S. lawmakers, accused Turkey of supporting and funding ISIS through illegal weapons and oil sales with the terrorist group. The King of Jordan also claimed that Turkey was deliberately causing the refugee crisis in Europe and was allowing Daesh terrorists to infiltrate Europe. The king called Turkey a major challenge for peace and claimed the Turkish president, Erdogan, was attempting to radicalize Islam in the Middle East.
3 days of mourning began in Pakistan Monday following an Easter Sunday suicide bombing in a park in Lahore, which killed more than 70 people, most of them women and children. From Pakistan, FSRN's Malik Ayub Sambal has more.
Ambulances raced to Lahore's Gulshan-e-Iqbal Park on Easter Sunday after a suicide bomber triggered an explosion, killing at least 70 people, dozens of them children. Another 400 were seriously injured in the centrally located park, packed with families and children. One witness, a young boy, said the blast happened at the main entrance of the park.
There was no security on the main gate of the park, and there was no security checking at the entrance. When I heard the blast, I fell down on the ground, and there were dead bodies and horrible scenes which I can't describe.
A splinter group from the Pakistani Taliban, Jamaatul Ahrar, has claimed responsibility for the Sunday attack and threatened to carry out more attacks until Sharia, Islamic law, is imposed in the country. The group says they targeted Christians, but the death toll of Muslims is double the number of Christians killed in the attack. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif immediately called an emergency meeting with the country's security high-ups and called for quick action against the militants who involved in this attack. Military operations are now underway in militant stronghold of southern Punjab province. With the force combined of intelligence agencies, the army and the rangers. Malik Ayub Sambal, FSRN, Pakistan.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones, Rosalind Scott, Don Zare, Jenna Yokoyama, and Jeff Henderson. The producer is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Alan Montesillo. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklas. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Republican Representative Greg Walden is 541-389-4408. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220 HR, Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on alternative radio, scholar and activist Tom Mayer speaks on Is the U.S. an Imperialist Nation? At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, D-May Roberts features Profile Theater's production of The Blue Door by Tanya Barfield. We'll hear from director Bobby Bermilla and actor Seth Rue. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews artists Dana Lynn Lewis and Vanessa Renwick, who both have work and shows at the Portland Art Museum. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The U.S. forced 120,000 Japanese Americans from their homes during World War II, all in the name of national security. Over 60 years later, a civil rights hero who fought this unjust policy is finally being recognized. Today is Minoru Yasui Day in Oregon, and in November 2015, he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. KBOO's Alan Montesillo interviewed two of Yasui's former colleagues to learn more about him.